Senator Palmacult will come to order. Will the Secretary please take the roll?
Today is Friday, March 31st, 2023. Chairman Lenz.
Here.
Senator Beard.
Here.
Senator Glimm.
Here.
Senator Gross.
Here.
Senator Heinbach.
Here.
Senator Kelker.
Excused.
Senator Molnar.
Excused.
Senator Weber.
Excused.
Senator McGillivray.
Excuse.
Senator Walber is online, and I will promote her.
Thank
okay.
you. Thank you.
All right. We're good. Thank you. All right, members. We have four bills before us today. We are going to open with House Bill 29. Representative Carlson, would you open on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name for the record is Representative Jennifer Carlson, C-A-R-L-S-O-N, from House District 69. I'm bringing before you today House Bill 29, which is a committee bill at the request of the Human Services Interim Committee. In very shortest definition or description of this bill, Mr. Chair, the committee directs the Department of Health to stop admitting people to Montana State Institution for people with serious mental illness, those who are having a primary diagnosis of Alzheimer's or traumatic brain injury without the required diagnoses of a serious disabling mental illness. That work is to be begun now, finding placements for those who are there under that description. The work shall be done by July 1st, 2025, and the practice of admitting those people there will be ended. I would like to direct you, well, I'll just tell you, and I'm reading from page 6 of the bill, or 5 of the bill, pardon me, and sub 7 down there, that already says in the law that if the court relies solely upon the criterion of 1D, which is the person cannot provide for their needs, the court may require commitment only to a community facility, which may include a Category D assisted living, which we currently do not have any of those available, or a program or an appropriate course of treatment as provided, and may not require commitment at the state hospital. So this isn't a new idea that we're bringing forth, but we are putting in some guidelines. This bill also includes a task force that will oversee the work and an appropriation to complete the work. I do want to just briefly mention the fiscal note, and I hope that in your packet with the fiscal note you have my rebuttal note. This fiscal note is exceptionally problematic because the work that is included in this bill is required to be completed by July 1st, 2025. But the fiscal note goes on until July 1st, 2028, with multiple millions of dollars being required during the years after the work is supposed to be completed. I'm not going to read my fiscal note to you, but I will just state that the intention of the committee bill is that these people will be put in the least restrictive environment possible. The fiscal note only takes into consideration moving people into the highest restrictive settings at the highest cost. And so on the back page, I've done a couple calculations of what it should actually cost per year to move people to a lower restrictive, more appropriate placement, which is a federal requirement to do that. There should be a substantial savings because the cost of keeping someone in a least restrictive placement is much less. Currently at Warm Springs, you, I'm sure, are well aware of the process that happened during the interim with Warm Springs losing CMS certification. The cost there skyrocketed, and we were going into the hole and still are millions of dollars because there is no federal match for any of that care. Moving a person from Warm Springs cannot get more expensive. There is no more expensive place in the state of Montana to house an individual than Warm Springs, except possibly barring the intensive behavior center, which would definitely not be an appropriate placement. So I just wanted to point that out, because during the interim committee, when we were going through this bill, we heard from the department of several different opinions, one being that this bill wouldn't be necessary because they don't do this practice of putting people with solely Alzheimer's diagnosis at Warm Springs. And then it came out in the fiscal note hearing in House Appropriations that if this bill were to pass, every single person at Spratt Unit would have to be transferred, which I don't believe is true. Just a couple of days before that, my most recent data from the department through the staff in the basement was that there were 6 to 12 people at Warm Springs who fit this criteria that would need to be moved into an alternate placement. So it's not a heavy load. It's the right thing to do. If people do not have a serious disabling mental illness, they do not belong in the state hospital for people with mental illness. And I would ask that we do the right thing and find a better place that's more appropriate and least restrictive for people to receive the best care. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. We will go to proponents in the room. Proponents.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Claire Marshall. That's M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L. I am here with the Alzheimer's Association Montana chapter, and the Alzheimer's Association supports House Bill 29. The Alzheimer's Association represents 22,000 individuals living in Montana with Alzheimer's and dementia. Alzheimer's is a mind-robbing disease that interferes with daily life. It's a public health crisis that will only continue to exacerbate in coming years due to the longer average lifespans and expected growth in the population of older Montanans. Montana State Hospital is not only the most expensive level of treatment, but also the most restrictive environment and the least appropriate setting for individuals living with Alzheimer's. People living with dementia require caregivers who are trained in dementia care, and the state hospital cannot provide that. I want to thank the bill sponsor and the interim committee that studied the issue of people with dementia who are involuntarily committed to the state hospital through HJR 39. House Bill 29 was supported and approved by the interim committee and lays out a thoughtful and comprehensive approach to reducing involuntary commitments of people living with dementia. It's important to note that an effort to simply prohibit involuntary transfers without other support will have severe unintended consequences. Any process to reduce involuntary commitments must include stakeholders to help identify and implement community resources and solutions for people who experience dementia-related behaviors and for the care providers that serve them. This legislation successfully accomplishes this by establishing a transition review committee to support the department in developing its plan to end involuntary commitments of people living with dementia. People living with Alzheimer's and dementia deserve a care setting that adequately meets their needs. The Montana State Hospital is not an appropriate setting for those living with dementia in most cases. Please help ensure that Montanans living with Alzheimer's are given the care they need by supporting House Bill 29. The Alzheimer's Association urges a do pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Marshall. Further proponents, please.
Good afternoon, Chairman Lenz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Adrienne Cotton, C-O-T-T-O-N, here representing AARP Montana and our 145,000 members across the state. Our belief is that older Montanans and caregivers should be provided a variety of residential and community-based care options. We firmly believe in maintaining the rights and the freedoms of individuals during advanced aging, and that home and community-based care services should be both bolstered and prioritized. We especially appreciate the bipartisan efforts of the Children, Family, Health, and Human Services Interim Committee and Representative Carlson for carrying this bill forward. We also share her concerns with the fiscal note. Thank you for your time, and we urge it to pass.
Thank you. Further proponents.
Chair Lenz, members for the committee, my name is Maggie Bornstein, spelled B-O-R-N-S-T-E-I-N, here on behalf of the ACLU of Montana. We traditionally work on a swath of big issues, but this leads us back to our work in the criminal legal reform area. As many folks, as we know, are ending up in the state hospital with TBIs and dementia through the process of involuntary commitment. We think that this is a really important step in realizing the United States Supreme court decision Olmstead that really set forth groundbreaking standards of ensuring that there is available community care for these vulnerable populations and allowing them to have the liberty of remaining in their communities. So we are gratefully able to support this today. We're happy to support this, and we thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Further proponents in the room? Further proponents? I will go to proponents online. I have one proponent.
Mr. Chairman, she is not online.
Okay. Okay. So I will move to opponents. Opponents in the room.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chad Parker, spelled P-A-R-K-E-R. I am the Deputy Chief Legal Counsel for the Department of Public Health and Human Services. We rise in opposition to this bill as we have in the House, as well as during the interim committee, we expressed our concerns with the bill. Those concerns really have not changed. We believe the intent of the legislation is understandable, absolutely understandable. However, if you have a mechanically unsound bill that won't achieve the purpose that it set out to do, then it's legislation that we feel we have to oppose. We're the ones who are mechanically responsible for handling these cases. We've set out before different committees in the past why this is a mechanically unsound bill. Primarily, however, we would like to reiterate that for this committee, in that, first and foremost, the mechanics of getting a person committed to the state hospital, especially the Sprat wing, is completely contingent upon other parties other than the department. We are a recipient of individuals because of a court order. A court order is established by a district court judge after a prosecutor, appointed counsel, as well as the court, analyze both a professional person's analysis as well as other testimony might be presented during a court proceeding. During that court proceeding, a professional person will provide testimony typically or a report that speaks to whether or not Alzheimer's, dementia, or traumatic brain injury actually is a primary diagnosis or in fact a mental illness. If they have a mental illness that in fact would require their commitment, then that's what leads them to the order that leads them to us and for our care. Right now, we've suggested in the past, we would suggest again, that the primary problem with this bill is that there is no provision for changing the definition of mental illness. We've suggested those amendments in the past, they've been ignored. Alzheimer's, dementia, and traumatic brain injury can still be determined because of the differentiation between mental illness as we understand it and neurocognitive disorders like Alzheimer's, dementia, and traumatic brain injury. That has not been changed in law. This bill does not change that in law. That needs to be changed in law. The other point of this is that primary diagnosis is a misnomer. A professional person, whenever they analyze an individual who may, in fact, have mental illness, as well as Alzheimer's or dementia or traumatic brain injury, could in fact consider Alzheimer's, dementia, or traumatic brain injury as a mental illness. And they still come to us the same way. They either make it as a primary diagnosis or they make it as the secondary diagnosis. If they make it as a secondary diagnosis because they believe that the state hospital is the least restrictive environment for a person who has a mental disease or a mental illness, such as those that present here, or in combination. Say they have a dual diagnosis of Alzheimer's or dementia or traumatic brain injury and some other mental illness, that presentation could come before the professional person in varying degrees at different points in their life, and they still could end up with the state hospital. By setting this forth, by having that mechanical flaw in this bill, it does not achieve the purposes that the bill is intended to achieve. We have suggested amendments. We're still willing to suggest more amendments to the bill. We believe that the legislation needs to be reviewed in that regard. Otherwise, it just will not work. There are other aspects of this bill. There's been a lot of back and forth on this throughout the different committees. And it's important that we emphasize the fact that this work is being done. The work is being done to try and find community providers who could take these individuals if, in fact, the state hospital is not the least restrictive environment. In the geropsychiatric world, you have individuals who typically require the most comprehensive degree of care. And the only place right now that could be provided, according to the courts and their decisions, is at the state hospital. Trying to find community providers is difficult. It's not something that can be done in a rapid-fire manner. The timeline, we believe, that is established in this bill is also too short for that. The best analogy in many ways to this is if you walked into a kitchen, someone else had just come in, they just changed shift, and there's dishes all over the place. We're the new people on shift, we're cleaning the dishes. People come in and see the pile of dishes and say, what have you been doing in here when your shift just started? The department is very much in that circumstance right now. We are trying to make certain that all these problems are resolved, but we have to have the time to do so. We have to have the resources to do so, as well as the mechanics of this need to be corrected. I'm also available for questions if need be afterwards, but we urge that you do not pass this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. Further opponents in the room? Seeing none. Informational witnesses? Informational witnesses? Seeing none. Questions from the committee? Senator Groves?
Sure, Mr. Chair, for Mr. Parker. Mr. Chair, Mr. Parker, this definition of mental illness that needs to be changed in law, what statute are you referring to?
Chairman Lenz, members of the committee, Senator Gross, within the, I believe it's in Title 53 is where we have to look at it. I don't have my particular note right now. However, I can provide that specific citation to you afterwards.
All right. And
if I could take a moment and look through my notes.
Yeah, that would be fine. Mr. Chair, let's go with Ms. Marshall.
Ms. Marshall?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Marshall. Can you speak to some like the least restrictive environment, and you work or represent folks with this particular diagnosis of Alzheimer's, and are there in most cases least restrictive environments for individuals outside of the state hospital, and can you discuss what those are, please?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair and Senator Gross. I think I would say the least restrictive environment would be aging at home, of course, and that is not a possibility for most families and a lot of aging Montanans. And then I would be comfortable in saying going down the line of assisted living, memory care, and then a nursing home, and then the state hospital being the last. Or the most restrictive, excuse me, if that answers your question, Senator.
Yes, and Ms. Marshall, I had another question. Forgive me, it's been a really long week. I may call you back up in a moment, if that's okay.
Do you want to go back to Mr. Parker?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if he has the citation.
Mr. Parker?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Gross, the citation would be Title 53, it is 53-21-102, and it should be 9. So 53-21-102-9. That currently includes the definition of mental illness. We can see also there's an exception listed therein. That exception could be added to exclude these features so that that would actually instruct the courts and others how to handle this, as well as other features of the bill that we've given some challenges to. We believe that could be some additional work on this.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. Mr. Chair, for the sponsor, please.
Yes, the sponsor. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I know that this probably isn't the first time that you have discussed this definition, nor is it the first time that I have heard about it, but can you talk about what is the issue with citing that as one of the primary reasons for declaring the bill mechanically unsound?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gross, I not quite sure I tracked your question, and I don't have my my way to look that up right now to see exactly what we're talking about. There is an amendment to Title 53 in the bill, as you'll see on page 3, which is in 5321.127. So I guess I'd have to see what that citation that was quoted in here. But that does change, and in that change there in Section 2 of the bill, it says a respondent must be discharged and the petition dismissed if upon trial it is determined that the respondent is not suffering from a mental disorder or does not require commitment within the meaning of this part, or is suffering from a mental disorder but the respondent's primary diagnosis is Alzheimer's, other forms of dementia, or traumatic brain injury, and the respondent meets only the commitment criteria lined out in 5221.126, which is, I believe, Section 1 of the bill. So, I mean, it's not that we didn't attempt to address that definition. So if there's something that was missed, I don't have that in front of me right now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson. I'll just read you the definition since I was able to look it up here. And it's for mental disorder, defining mental disorder in the, Title 53, Chapter 21, which is mentally ill, and then Part 1, which is treatment of the seriously mentally ill. So mental disorder means any organic mental or emotional impairment that has substantial adverse effects on an individual's cognitive or volitional functions. And then exceptions, the term does not include addiction to drugs or alcohol, drug or alcohol intoxication, intellectual disability, or epilepsy. It also says that a mental disorder may co-occur with addiction or chemical dependency. I'm not quite sure. I can't tell at this moment, but in your opinion, if it is one of the matters being a definition that is perhaps not aligning, isn't that something that could be probably fixed pretty easily in this bill?
I'm not positive that it could be fixed pretty easily. As the opponent said, it was brought up, it was reviewed with the drafter, and that is why it says is suffering from a mental disorder, but and there's exceptions in this because there are times in the mental disorder code. You'll have to forgive me. This bill was actually presented the first week of January, and it was obviously drafted last summer. So the discussion was something like this. There might be an instance where it is... We do not want to create an exemption in the entire mental code, mental health code for this because it might not always be appropriate for that. So that's why the exception is in the code that's changed in this bill.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, you framed your answer the way I intended to frame my question. Thank you. And I still cannot remember my question for Ms. Marshall at this time, Mr. Chair.
Well, if you think of it, we've got some other ones. Senator Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the sponsor, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am pretty new to this whole venue of public health and human services and welfare and so forth. But I did want to ask you, Representative, do you see the closure of community providers across the state providing facilities that are less restrictive kind of a barrier to provide more appropriate facilities for these specific individuals to which you're referencing?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator, I absolutely do. And as a matter of fact, I had a bill. It's actually on second reading today. To add, I got a significant haircut in appropriations, but to add a supplemental payment for nursing homes. I believe that one of the things that has been really forgotten in the larger discussion about nursing homes is this topic. if there, and that's why this bill allows spending in the backside of this bill, is there an allowance for spending some more money to make sure that these more appropriate, least restrictive venues exist? And so I really believe that we need to pass this bill, and we need to say this is a priority for Montanans. We have to have places for people to age who need care that are not, people do not deserve to be in the state mental hospital, which is lost funding for having so many violations. And that is what we call the placement of last resort for people who need care in a residential place and can't find it in their community. So these topics are interconnected. I do believe that.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
Follow-up for the sponsor representative. So I see that, according to your rebuttal, first I'll go to the fiscal note. I see that it starts out pretty low cost, and then it just immediately jumps in the second fiscal year. I don't understand why it would jump that high, except for the fact that you put in your rebuttal that the current placement at Warm Springs would be almost three times higher than, say, something that a community nursing home would be quite a bit less expensive and would be matched with some federal dollars at that level. So could you explain the difference between the fiscal note's $2.3 million and how we could save some money potentially?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can't explain the fiscal note at all, actually. One of the assumptions made in the fiscal note in number five, I believe it is, says that if we relocate individuals under House Bill 29, those spots will be immediately filled and therefore no savings will be realized. And so even though I'm not sure what kind of math that is, but we're talking about people. And if we're taking a person who's costing the state $1,000 a day with no Medicaid match, and we're finding a more suitable placement for that individual, even at mental health nursing home in Lewistown, as you can see on here, is a bit lower than that. Sorry, I don't have it off the top of my head. It looks like $500 a day. That's a savings. So the fact that they're going to have someone else fill the bed at Warm Springs, they're using to negate any savings. And so I don't understand that. I don't understand how these fiscal notes are working. We just had a bill that spends $1 million and the fiscal note was zero. So I'm not seeing how this is working. But this fiscal note, the reason I wrote the rebuttal is because I don't believe this bill does a specific thing. It takes 12 people who do not belong in Warm Springs and puts them in a more appropriate care that costs $600 a day less to begin with, and it comes with a 90% match or 65% match for Medicaid. And you're going to tell me that we're not going to save any money. That's not math. I don't know what that is. I can't really help you with your question.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair.
Senator Gross.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. For Ms. Marshall, I think it's a pretty general question.
Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Marshall, I would love to hear your take on what we heard from the opponent today.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gross, I think there are some things I agree with. I think Alzheimer's is not a mental disorder, and if it's in a definition somewhere as a mental disorder, I think we need to change that. It's a brain disease. I also think that the core of the bill is to put people deserving of care in an appropriate care setting, and I think that should be very important to all of us, and I think that should be on our top of the list and figure out a way to do so.
Mr. Chair, may I ask the same question of Ms. Cotton?
Ms. Cotton?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gross, I would echo Ms. Marshall's comments and then also add that there was plenty of opportunity to make changes in the interim committee.
All right. And Mr. Chair, the same question of Ms. Bornstein.
Ms. Bornstein? She's not here anymore. All right. Okay. Well, I have a question for Chad Parker, please.
Chairman Lenz, members of the committee.
So, Mr. Parker, so it's causing me to pause just a tad. In the context of this bill, was our interim committee was trying to hunt for a solution. We don't think the placements are correct. That was, you could just generally say, we don't like the way this looks. And yet, the department is moving forward with a kind of as yet fully defined new mental health system. And like the first thing out of the door with many of these laws is definitions. Mm-hmm. So I'm very curious why the department, when they could see from the summer what our concerns were, that you didn't move forward bills to change that definition.
Chairman Lenz, members of the committee, I know it's been some time, and with respect, I even recall my own testimony from that time speaking about the shortfall with the definition of mental illness during the interim committee period. That was a matter that we attempted to work with the committee. We attempted to work with the sponsor and others to make this amendment, to make this change, and that was disregarded. Don't understand exactly why that was. It's not my place to say. It's not my decision. I can make the challenge. I can explain legally why it doesn't work. I still believe, and the department believes, that it still does not work as it currently is written. As well as, because of that definitional problem, the concept that we will be removing 12 individuals one time and that will solve this issue, that is flawed logic. Because of what I was stating earlier, and because the fact that the court may still determine, and they're likely to, if the definition of mental disorder is not changed in -102, they will still send individuals to the state hospital to be cared for in the same manner that they are at Spratwing currently. We don't have standing to challenge that. We don't represent the state. The county attorney does in that regard. We are constantly trying to work with stakeholders to correct concepts and adjust people's understanding and attitudes, working with county attorneys, the courts, and others. However, there's nothing mechanically right now in this bill that will stop that. I believe that is the goal. That's my understanding of the goal of this, is that by altering 5321, 126, and 127, which are the operative sections that help create the commitment to the state hospital, that is the goal. However, these individual points were raised. They still need to be adjusted, in our opinion.
So, Mr. Parker, I see your point. So, within the context of the committee, of bringing this up within the committee disagreed with you. At the same time, the committee moved forward many of the pre-drafting bill requests that the department asked for. The department could have, and I have expressed this frustration to Director Brereton, that we will have discussions behind the scenes that here's this problem that we have to address, yet the department doesn't bring that forward. You could have, at any point, brought forward your own bill, your own idea, to say here, based upon where we are right now, where we want to go, that definition obviously needs to be changed, not just for this bill, but for what you want to accomplish. And so why did you not?
Senator Lenz, Chairman Lenz, members of the committee, I can't speak to those kind of executive decisions. As Deputy Chief Legal Counsel, I analyze and provide advice. I do a lot of written work behind the scenes, of course, after giving an assignment, and give appropriate advice. on those matters, but I can't speak to that. However, I know that we as a department still stand ready and willing to work with this committee as well as the legislature as a whole to make legislation that does work, that serves the citizenry of Montana in the way that we are all committed to do, especially for this very, very vulnerable population. Mm-hmm. Part of my daily work is trying to provide appropriate legal advice such that problems that could attach to this population and that they could be subjected to problems, we're trying to avoid that at all points along the line, and it's a daily struggle to do so. But we are very willing to work with the legislature and each one of you in trying to make all this better.
Well, Mr. Parker, I think we've turned that corner. I sense we may have turned that corner. But it is odd that you, as legal counsel, are here instead of someone who could discuss the policy, why we do the policy. Legal counsel oftentimes is behind the curve. You don't want to do that. You don't want to go there. That's a little sketchy, which isn't that helpful. And you can pass that down. I'll just leave that with a statement.
Thank you for your commentary. I appreciate it, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with all of you.
Okay. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Carlson, would you like to close on your bill?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me today. I feel like I've been in this room a lot lately. It's kind of nice. I wanted to just address a couple of things that were said today. And they sound like this to me, as a person who's been working on this bill since 2021. We can't do it. We are already doing it. This is the first beginning of our shift, although we started working on this bill in 21, and the work doesn't have to be done until 2025. So those are very frustrating things to tell a person who's working to fix a problem, that you can't do it, but you're already doing it. That doesn't track. This is not the beginning of the shift. We are on year three. It's time to get something done, and it's time to stop. I would like to see an amendment, but I will tell the committee that in good faith, we worked on this concern, and as I explained to Senator Gross, we addressed the problem. The thing I read to you on the bottom of page 3 is the directions in the commitment of a person, and it's clear that if the person suffers from a mental disorder and the respondent's primary diagnosis is Alzheimer's, is not the only part of that code, because then it goes on to say what the court can do and what happens if the court requires a commitment and where that person can go and what is appropriate and what is allowed. And it keeps going on to the legislative intent and to the next page. So that one sentence isn't the only part of this bill. And so going forward, it's very frustrating to watch what's happening at Warm Springs, to watch how much money we're spending, and to watch and hear people tell me that it's the placement of last resort. And in some way, that's supposed to make me feel better about how awful it is. It doesn't make me feel better, and it doesn't make the family members of the people feel better, and it doesn't make the situation better. So if we had an amendment that fixed a definition in a different area of the code and that made the department happy and it didn't hurt anything else that we don't know about that we're not trying to fix, maybe the committee should consider that. But when I'm being handed a fiscal note that requires 2 FTEs forever and 0.5 FTE to move these people who at one point never existed and now includes everyone there, and I'm getting a lot of mixed messages, and if you think that's confusing, the committee got those same mixed messages for 18 months. And so we're trying to do our best to get something done. That's one of the reasons that this bill includes a transition review committee, because we don't want to just listen to someone say we can't do it, but we're already doing it. We want to see it happen, and we want to make sure there's oversight and that this problem gets fixed. I would urge a due pass. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. This ends the hearing. We will open the hearing on House Joint Resolution 12, please. Representative Knutson, would you like to open on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Casey Knudsen, K-N-U-D-S-E-N. I represent House District 33 up on the High Line. I bring before the committee today House Joint Resolution 12. It's requesting the federal government ban pharmaceutical ads on public airwaves. I look at this practice, and I think, as you all know, a pretty staunch supporter of, you know, free speech, capitalistic society. But this practice, the only group that this benefits are these large multinational corporations and their bottom line. This really drives patients to try to sell to their doctors rather than doctors doing what's actually in the best interest of their patients. It drives a lot of pharmaceutical treatments that could otherwise be handled by, you know, lifestyle choices or other things. Now, I'm definitely not saying that's all of them, but I do believe that's a big driver because of this practice. So, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. We'll go to proponents in the room for House Joint Resolution 12. Proponents. No proponents online. Opponents to House Joint Resolution 12. Opponents, none online. Informational witnesses. Informational witnesses. Questions from the committee. Senator Groves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the sponsor. And I got to apologize to you as well, Representative Knudsen. I'm very tired. I think it's Friday afternoon. I know that you are very strong on issues of speech, and so it's interesting to see this bill from you. But what can you tell me? Is it the FCC that regulates our airwaves?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gross, the Federal Communications Commission.
Yeah. Okay.
I do not know specifically what federal agency would be in charge of something like this. And no apology necessary. I'm pretty sure this week has lasted about a month.
Yeah. Truth. Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Representative Knudsen, thank you for the answer. And help us understand how... this is not a violation of our First Amendment rights.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gross, you know, we do this with a lot of other products as well. Alcohol is very heavily regulated as far as what it can advertise, how it can advertise. Tobacco cannot advertise on television. You used to be able to see commercials for cigarette products, tobacco products. I'm pretty sure the only place you see them now, if they even can still, I guess probably the last time I looked at a magazine has been quite a while, but you used to see the ads in the magazines because that was the only way they could advertise. I don't know if that's still the case. When the public health, when a practice puts the public health in jeopardy, I think that's when we as the government step in and say, no, we're not going to do this anymore. Like I said in my opening, I believe this, you know, this practice, the heavy advertising of these pharmaceutical products does not benefit patients. It tends to make us look at patients as consumers. And with a lot of these products, that's just not the case. And, of course, I am, you know, pretty staunch on my First Amendment rights. I'm also a very strong supporter of, you know, vaccines. So I'm definitely not trying to attack our medical community by any means. I think there are some products out there that are pretty amazing as far as what they've been able to do for people to extend life, to, increase quality of life. But my biggest problem is just that it really puts a big wall in between the patient and the doctor, when those are the two people that should be making these decisions, not the company trying to sell their drug. A lot of times this stuff, these products are a product that's been around for, 30 years that they just, can re-up the patent on by changing the formula just a little bit, and now they have this big new product they can sell. It pushes away a lot of the more generic products, so it increases the cost of healthcare, in my opinion. And like I said in my opening, I think a lot of things can be taken care of, with lifestyle changes. You don't always, for every case, need, you know, some type of diet medication, weight loss medication, where lifestyle changes can take effect. I'll stop babbling. I'm sorry.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me just turn this up a little bit. For the sponsor, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knudsen, has other states introduced this type of joint resolution to prohibit prescription drug advertising? Go ahead.
I apologize, Senator. Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, I do not know the answer to that question, not that I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the sponsor of this very interesting resolution.
Senator Knudsen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beard.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Knudsen, you know, in my household, I just don't pay for any TV. I don't have much for streaming except maybe a couple freebies. And I turn the TV off pretty much all the time. But what do you suppose, Representative, would happen to our legacy media and free streaming channels if they had to forego the copious amount of dollars they receive from the advertisers of these pharmaceuticals?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beard, it's certainly a large funding stream. I think, you know, and this is part of the reason I was fairly broad with this and kept it to just public airwaves. You know, you can get into the weeds very quickly when you start getting into the internet-based streaming. You know, there's plenty of advertising for all sorts of products on the internet that aren't necessarily allowed on our, what you call legacy public airwaves, radio and, you know, public television type stuff. I don't have a good answer for you other than it is a big chunk of change that they bring in.
Just a little bit of follow-up to clarify.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative, what do you think would happen to the profit and loss statements and the business models going forward for these public airwaves, personnel, staff, and programming?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beard, it really is an interesting question that you pose. You know, with the size, I mean, we've all seen on television just how many of these advertisements there are. I would suppose it would be a pretty big hit on a lot of the bottom lines for some of these networks. Could be. It really could. It could very much affect their ability to continue broadcasting.
Thank you.
Senator Heimbaugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask the good representative a question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Heimbaugh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knudsen, is there any, maybe I missed it in here, but is there any place where we can stop the federal government and the state government for campaigning or for advertising for all these drug companies? You can't already turn the radio on without them doing that for some vaccine or something someplace. So.
Mr. Chair, Senator Heinbaugh, I went this direction with it because I think it's important we make a statement more than anything. I mean, we all know this is a letter to Santa Claus. It does not accomplish anything other than making a statement, right? I don't necessarily believe in a patchwork of, you know, regulations involving, you know, television, radio, that kind of thing across the whole country. I chose to go with the federal government just for the simple fact that I think making that statement at the federal level is more important than trying to come up with our own set of regulations for Montana by itself regarding this issue. I don't know what the involvement is. I suppose with the vaccine issue, especially with COVID, and that's certainly not where this resolution's coming from, but with the federal, especially the federal involvement with some of the COVID money coming in, getting, you know, localities, state governments to advertise for, you know, the COVID vaccine, stuff like that. I would assume that might be able to fall into this if you interpret it broadly. My intent was more the private companies that are trying to just push their heart medication, or like we've seen the opioid lawsuit. You know, it's products like that I was going after, not so much on the vaccination side.
So one follow-up, Mr. Chair. Well, if there's a way to mend that in here, I wouldn't mind trying to do that, if that's all right with you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Heimbaugh, I'm willing to look at whatever the committee has to bring.
Representative Knutson, what will we do to replace the catchy jingles that go through our head unbidden at any given moment?
Mr. Chair, I'm hoping that... with the advent on Twitter of how sassy the chair will excuse me, the Wendy's company has gotten, I think we might be able to come up with something to fill that airtime.
Thank you, Representative. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, would you like to close on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the questions. It's a pretty broad issue. I kept it that way very specifically. Didn't want to get too far into the weeds on anything, but just I think it's important for our state to make a statement that, you know, with these massive corporations, we do not prioritize the corporate bottom line over our citizens. So that's pretty much where I'm coming from on this. Again, I appreciate the hearing. Thank you all very much. And I close and would urge do concur. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Knutson. This ends the hearing on House Joint Resolution 12. Senator Gillette, do you have a preference in which bill goes first?
If it's okay with you, do you think we could do House Bill 544 first, Mr. Chair? That's prior authorization for abortion services. Okay.
Representative Gillette, you can open on House Bill 544.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi. Happy afternoon. It's been a busy day for us on the House side, for sure. Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Representative Jane Gillette. I'm from House District 64, which is in Gallatin County. That's Four Corners, Gallatin Gateway, Big Sky, and West Yellowstone. And today I'm here to bring to you House Bill 544. House Bill 544 requires prior authorization for abortion services that are provided through our state Medicaid or CHIP plan. You might already know that prior authorization for services is very common. We have a contractor already that does our prior authorization services. We even do like prior authorization for things that are pretty mundane, like braces for kids. You might also know that DPHHS recently posted a rule notice about this very topic, and this bill is actually based on their rules. It's nearly identical. It's just in a little bit different format to meet the requirements of drafting MCA. I'm not going to go through every detail of it, but it's things that you would expect. For instance, that abortion is permitted under our state Medicaid plans when the mother's life is in danger. If the pregnancy is a result of an act of rape or incest, and then when the abortion is deemed to be medically necessary. And basically what the DPHHS rule and then this proposed bill right here does is start to clarify what is medically necessary. In case you're wondering about how long of a time it takes to do prior authorization, it takes up to 72 hours. It could take less than that, but it takes up to 72 hours. There is a provision in here that says that if an abortion is needed out of a medical emergency, that that's okay. The provider can move ahead, and there is a post-service prepayment review. So before the provider is paid, they send all the information that would be required for the prior authorization. They send it in, and then should the information that they sent in be appropriate, the department will pay for the service. I'm not going to go over every detail about the types of information that's required to be set in, sent in, but it's things that you would probably expect and seem normal, like the woman's medical history, number of pregnancies, number of live births, if she's had smoking or substance abuse issues. And with that, Mr. Chair, I think I have covered it all. It's been a while since I've looked at this draft, so I'll just double, triple check I'm not missing anything. No, it looks like I've got it all. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gillette. Could I see a show of hands as to who's here to testify on this bill as a proponent? Proponent in the room? Opponent in the room? Okay. All right. And I have several opponents and proponents online. So I will start with proponents in the room. Proponents in the room? I'm going to thank you, Senator Heimbach. We're going to aim around 2 minutes. I'll warn you at about 2 minutes, and then you'll need to wrap it up. Proponents in the room? Seeing none. Proponent online, Jeff Laslaffy.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, Jeff Laslaffy, L-A-S-Z-L-O-F-F-Y, with the Montana Family Foundation. As we talk about this bill, I think it's important to note what this bill is not about. So the bill is not about prohibiting abortion. The bill is not about abortions performed when a mother's life is in danger. The bill is not about abortions performed when the pregnancy is the result of a rape or incest. And the bill is not an unconstitutional measure that runs afoul of the Montana Supreme Court's decision in Armstrong. We expect you'll hear these sorts of arguments from opponents, but these arguments don't address the bill that's before you. The bill is about fiscal responsibility and ensuring the solvency of Montana's Medicaid program. House Bill 544 has its root in a court decision from almost 30 years ago. That was the case of Jeanette R. V. Ellery. In that case, the district court determined that Montana statutes do, quote, not give the department authority to limit or eliminate, end quote, the provision of abortion services, quote, unless there are insufficient funds to provide medical assistance for all eligible people, end quote. The court made this determination in the face of the federal Hyde Amendment, which prohibits federal taxpayer dollars from being used to fund abortion services. So based on this legal framework, the court held that DPHHS has an obligation to pay for only medically necessary abortions. Put another way, the court recognized that paying for non-medically necessary abortions can actually jeopardize the financial solvency of the entire Medicaid program. Fast forward to today, Montana taxpayer money is being used to fund abortions for Medicaid-eligible women, but under our current statutes, DPHHS does not receive sufficient documentation to ensure that abortions funded with taxpayer money are in fact medically necessary. So how do we make sure that only medically necessary abortions are being paid for by Montana taxpayers? That's what House Bill 544 seeks to address. The bill gives DPHHS the tools it needs to protect the solvency of the entire Medicaid program, and the information that would be required for reporting under 544 is not burdensome. The bill asks for things like medical history, the results of a physical examination, a review of the symptoms related to why the abortion is medically necessary, and the medical reason for the abortion procedure. The information sought under this bill is common sense and narrowly tailored to ensure that relevant information is submitted to justify the medical necessity of abortion procedures funded by Montana taxpayers. For that reason, Mr. Chairman, we urge that you concur and vote yes for House Bill 544. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Laslaffy. Further proponents online? Seeing none, I will go to opponents in the room.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Robin Turner from the American Civil Liberties Union of Montana and also opposing on behalf of the Montana Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. I'd ask for a little extra time since I'm covering two clients. So this bill defines what constitutes medically necessary in more restrictive terms and requires even more unnecessary steps and paperwork where the dire situation presents itself of a pregnancy endangering the life of a pregnant person. Montana's Constitution, as you well know, provides some of the strongest protections in the nation for privacy, procreative autonomy, and equal protection. Under the Montana Constitution and case law, an individual has a right to access health care, including a pre-viability abortion from a qualified health care provider. The choice to exercise this constitutional right should not be dependent on income. This violates the spirit and the letter of both the statutory and constitutional law of Montana. All Montanans have the right to individual dignity and are entitled to and deserving of equal treatment under the law. You heard reference to the Jeanette R. v. Ellery case. This is a case where the district court held that Montana's constitutional rights to privacy, procreative autonomy, and equal protection prohibited DPHHS from limiting access to abortion care services through its rules. The state cannot create a general program that provides medical student services to low-income Montanans and then selectively pluck out abortion care for differential treatment by withholding that benefit. The right to privacy protects an individual from undue government influence, and although the state is under no obligation to fund an individual's choice to a right of privacy, once it has entered the areas covered by that zone of privacy, the state must be neutral. This ban will have results, costly results for low-income patients in the state. If passed, this bill will lead to litigation and will be enjoined, ultimately opening the state to even more financial liability, including the potential of fee shifting. I will also note for the record that the DPHHS rule has not been adopted and it is currently pending. As far as my testimony for the Montana Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, I think you should be aware that reproductive coercion is a significant concern for survivors of domestic and sexual violence. Pregnancy is a vulnerable time. And it's even more vulnerable in abusive relationships. In the United States, pregnant women are more likely to die of homicide by an intimate partner than by any other pregnancy-related cause. Abortion may not be the choice all survivors make, but it is important that we allow them to have that option. And for survivors who choose to continue their pregnancies, they should be supported in seeking safety and resources. Reproductive and sexual coercion involves behavior intended to maintain power and control. The most common forms are sabotage of contraceptive
methods. Ms. Turner,
methods.
I'll have you wrap it up, please.
Yes, sir, I will. Thank you. May I just have one sentence to wrap up?
You can get her done here.
Yeah,
quick.
Sir. You know, I'm happy to answer more questions about reproductive coercion and the testimony I provided today, but for those reasons, we would like all pregnant people in Montana to have similar access to health care, and we ask that you not support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. I allowed Ms. Turner a little leeway on her open, but the title is an act providing requirements for coverage of physician services for abortion under Medicaid and children's health insurance, providing for prior authorization, providing that only abortion services provided by a physician are covered services. So I'd like us, as we move forward, because we have a lot of people to testify, if you'd stick close to the meaning of the bill. Thank you. And well, moving forward, it'll be 2 minutes per person.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Zuri Moreno, that's Zuri Moreno. And I'm here representing the Montana Budget and Policy Center. We rise in opposition to House Bill 544. Fundamentally, we believe that access to health care services should not depend on a person's socioeconomic status. This bill would create significant barriers to accessing reproductive care services for those on Medicaid. And the barriers this bill would create would also be at the cost of the state. As noted in the fiscal note, by mandating that only a physician can provide abortion care, House Bill 544 will increase provider rate costs for the state at almost $50 per abortion. This results in thousands of dollars in costs to the state. As shared in countless hearings this session, the state is already grappling with underfunded provider rates. Adding unnecessary costs will further burden our Medicaid system. I'm again going to look at the fiscal note, and based on assumption number 3, this shows that creating requirements for prior authorization and enhanced documentation will cost the state over $600,000 per year in state funds, as well as unnecessarily added time for the patient to wait to receive care, which actually could result in more invasive procedures or more expensive procedures. Access to safe, legal, and affordable abortion is an economic justice issue, and it affects the ability of Montana families to achieve economic security. Economic research shows that access to safe and legal abortion care increases an individual's opportunity for higher education, labor force participation, occupational prestige, and earnings. Denying access to abortion care...
Could you wrap it up, please?
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair. In a legislature that has debated investments of state dollars for Medicaid, provider rates, and affordable child care, passing this bill would create a financial strain for individuals, families, and, as I have shared here, the state. We urge a no vote. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I don't have a fiscal no.
I was just going to highlight that. She referenced that we have one coming for us. It is available online. Thank you, Senator. Further opponents in the room?
Mr. Chair, members in the committee, my name is Mary Collins. That's C-O-L-L-I-N-S. I'm here today to read testimony on behalf of the Women's Foundation of Montana, which rises in opposition to HB 544. The Women's Foundation of Montana supports women and girls in Montana through strategic grant making, policy change advocacy, and other initiatives. Our grantees and donors work and live in communities across Montana. Women are the co- or sole breadwinners in over 60% of Montana households. We believe when we invest in access to livable wages, affordable childcare, healthcare, equal pay, education, and job training, stronger families, communities, and economies result. The Women's Foundation of Montana believes sexual and reproductive health and autonomy are foundational to women's economic development. Abortion is a central part of women's health care. Our organization also envisions a state where women can be supported in all of their reproductive decisions, whether that be to maintain or terminate a pregnancy. Today, though, the Women's Foundation of Montana is providing testimony in opposition to additional restrictions on a woman's right to access abortion due to their economic status. Women should be able to make these decisions regardless of their economic status without additional government burden. A review of the Turnaway study provides some helpful insights into the economic impacts that women face if they are denied an abortion. This is the first study to closely examine the effects of receiving versus being denied a wanted abortion on women and their children. The study found serious consequences of being denied a wanted abortion on women's health and well-being. Women denied a wanted abortion who have to carry an unwanted pregnancy to term have 4 times greater odds of living below the federal poverty level and 3 times greater odds of being unemployed. There is an increased likelihood that women didn't have enough money to pay for basic family necessities like food, housing, and transportation if they were denied an abortion. Continuing an unwanted pregnancy and giving birth is associated with more serious health outcomes than an abortion. In conclusion, the Women's Foundation of Montana opposes HB 544 because of the undue restrictions placed upon women due to their economic status. We believe that women should have the choice to access abortion in a timely and safe manner, something HB 544 does not support.
Thank you. Further opponents?
Chairman Lenz, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Haley Hogan. That is spelled H-A-I-L-E-Y-H-O-G-A-N. I am here in opposition to HB 544. This bill disproportionately stigmatizes and punishes individuals on Medicaid seeking health care and will serve to increase health inequity across Montana. As an individual on Medicaid myself, I know how challenging it can be to navigate the healthcare system and find Medicaid providers. This bill will create further unnecessary hurdles to accessing healthcare for Medicaid recipients and unjustly seeks to hurt financially vulnerable individuals and communities. There are a variety of reasons one may need timely access to abortion services. This bill would make that process increasingly difficult, dependent on sharing deeply personal information, or impossible, purely based on socioeconomic status. Additionally, as previous testimony has pointed out, this bill is unconstitutional and would erode Montanans' right to equal protection under the law. I hope that you will vote no on 544. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hogan. Further opponents?
Good Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, esteemed members of the committee. My name is Tess Carlson, spelled C-A-R-L-S-O-N. I am from Missoula. I am not representing an organization today, but speaking on behalf of myself as a Montana constituent and a Medicaid recipient. I am speaking to oppose HB 544. I oppose this bill because it further prevents rural community members, low-income constituents, and Montanans with disabilities from receiving basic medical care. Abortion is basic medical care. If this bill were passed, 1 in 6 Montanans would be subject to even further surveillance of their bodies in the service of fulfilling governmental and insurance-based requirements. This bill would limit access to receiving basic medical care by preventing Montanans from receiving services from qualified nurse practitioners and physician assistants. This would be detrimental for rural communities who experience a shortage of physicians and rely on a diversity of providers to meet their healthcare needs. This would further limit Montanans' ability to make the best healthcare decisions for themselves. This bill increases red tape. It sanctions unconstitutional government intrusion into the private lives of Montanans and targets constituents who are disabled, low-income, and from rural communities. Finally, this bill would prevent Montanans from seeking basic medical care to ensure their mental safety. As a parent who experienced postpartum depression, I know in my bones that my mental safety is directly tied to my ability to control my own body, including reproductive autonomy. Thank you. I urge you to vote no on HB 544.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson. Next opponent in the room. Next opponent in the room. Seeing none, we will go online to Martha Fuller.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Martha Fuller. For the record, that's F-U-L-L-E-R. I'm the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Montana, and I rise today in opposition to House Bill 544. Access to Medicaid coverage for abortion with minimal barriers is critical to Montanans with low incomes. As another person offering testimony mentioned, the groundbreaking Turnaway study found that pregnant people who were denied access to abortion are more likely to live in poverty, as are their children. There are several provisions in this bill that would actually create significant barriers to abortion for Montanans on Medicaid. First of all, abortion is a time-sensitive health care. Delays in care can result in financial, physical, and emotional hardships for people seeking to end a pregnancy. Requiring pre-authorization essentially forces patients to receive government-mandated permission to end their pregnancy and could result in patients being forced to continue unwanted pregnancies or delay their abortions. Second, the bill narrows the definition of medical necessity for abortion care. Medical necessity is important, and it's specific to each patient and should be determined by the provider. The Medicaid program has existing protections in place to prevent fraud and abuse, protections that providers take very seriously. There's no need to insert an agency official into this process. Third, limiting the type of healthcare provider who can bill for abortion under Medicaid excludes physician assistants and nurse practitioners who are fully capable of providing that care and determining medical necessity. These providers are incredibly valuable to abortion care and should be compensated for their work under the Medicaid rules. Forcing people to borrow money or balance their needs for health care with their family's most basic economic needs, such as rent and food, doesn't change whether they want to or can continue to move forward with a pregnancy. It just makes it more burdensome to effectuate their own decisions about their reproductive health. This bill would place that burden directly on Montanans with Medicaid coverage, amounting to a ban on abortion for people who are living in poverty. I urge you to do not pass. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Katie George.
She is not online, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Stephanie McDowell.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephanie McDowell, M-C-D-O-W-E-L-L. I am here in opposition to House Bill 544 as the executive director of Bridger Care in Bozeman, where we provide reproductive and sexual health and education, including safe referral for abortion care. We wholeheartedly respect and support our patients' right to privacy and their options around all health care, including abortion. We believe that no one should be denied insurance coverage for an abortion just because they are low income and utilize public insurance. Opponents before me have spoken very eloquently to the harm and unconstitutionality of this bill, and I want to thank them for their testimony. I want to address the dehumanization of this bill. This bill requires that state Medicaid employees approve and validate that someone can have an abortion when their life is threatened by that pregnancy. So a pregnant person could die due to a pregnancy, and a stranger in a government office will tell them if Medicaid will cover an abortion that will save their life. That is at best dehumanizing and unethical, and it contradicts the claim that these bills, quote, protect life. Please stop these attacks on bodily autonomy on our most vulnerable neighbors at a time when they need our help most. And I want to help thank our healthcare providers and our patients who so bravely share their stories when it comes to abortion care. They are the folks who will be negatively impacted by this bill, and our hearts and gratitude go out to you. We urge a no vote on House Bill 544. Thank you.
Thank you. Andy Baldwin.
Hello, good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andy Baldwin. That's A-N-D-I-B-A-L-D-W-I-N. I'm here on behalf of my company, Profitable Ideas Exchange, or PIE, where I serve as Chief Operating Officer. We are a company employing about 70 people here in Bozeman, Montana. We create high-paying jobs in Montana, and our clients are primarily out of state, meaning we are a net importer of revenue to the state, and we could be based anywhere, but we're based in Montana because our people want to be here, and they care about sort of the freedoms and the access to individual rights that they have here. Our team is concerned about the potential curtailing of these rights that we're seeing in the legislature, and our clients and our employees care about the issue of access to abortion. Our current and potential team members care about living in a state that is inclusive and not moving in a direction that is taking away their rights. A number of our clients are Fortune 500 companies that have taken stances about the importance of maintaining women's rights to access to abortion and don't want to work with vendors or partners who are in states that are acting counter to this. So this is really important to the future and success of our business based here in Montana. While we do offer health insurance to our team members, and this particular bill may not impact our current employees, we feel very strongly about the need to speak out against any bill that seeks to make Montana a more restrictive and less inclusive state for our current or potential employees who may have less access to reproductive care or be less inclined to want to live here based on the changing nature of the state. We believe that passage of any bill that restricts complete access to the full spectrum of healthcare services needed by any Montanan, including abortion, is bad for our business and for other businesses. So we therefore urge a no vote. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Catherine Park.
Good afternoon to the chair and committee members. My name is Catherine Park, C-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E. P-A-R-K-E. I speak as an opponent of House Bill 544 on behalf of the Montana Democratic Socialists of America. House Bill 544 is one of multiple bills currently under consideration in the legislature that in similar, overlapping, or adjacent ways are flawed, discriminatory, unethical, and sometimes legally and medically unsound as they relate to women's reproductive health care, safety, freedom of choice regarding abortion, and privacy. In undermining these essential women's rights, these bills, it must be noted, also harm family life, the economy, and Montanans' cherished values of freedom and their commitment to the well-being of one another. I turn now specifically and very briefly to House Bill 544. As clearly identified in the detailed fiscal note and as identified by previous testifiers, this bill will result in a physical impact of higher costs. And by briefly referencing what previous testifiers have said, I'm not merely repeating but underscoring the foundational importance of the wrongness of this bill. So higher costs is identified in physical impact because only physicians could perform this service, and also additional paperwork would be required. Increased cost is, however, only part of the mistakenness of this bill. Timely access to abortion is crucial for this health care procedure, which narrows without sound medical reason the category of the provider who can perform the service, increases requirements for documentation, wrongly prohibits payment for contraception, and in addition, this bill, because of its funding sources, functions in discriminatory ways.
Ms. Park, could you wrap it up, please?
Women. Last sentence. This combination of harming Montana women and unnecessarily raising health care costs makes an absolutely clear and irrefutable argument against House Bill 5.
Thank you, Ms. Park. Thomas Roberts, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Roberts. I'm testifying in opposition to House Bill 544. I practiced internal medicine here in Missoula starting in 1981 and retired from medical practice 6 years ago. I not only provided direct medical care, I was the president of the Western Montana Clinic for 15 years, and I helped to start the Montana Health Co-op, which is a major health insurance company here in Montana. I was its first board chair of the co-op and its first medical director. In addition, I worked with Blue Cross for many years as an associate medical director. So I know a lot about how health insurance works, and specifically with regard to this bill, I have a lot of experience with the use of prior authorization. Prior authorization means that specific interventions will not be paid for by the insurance company unless the insurer and the provider go through a process of evaluating the reasoning involved beforehand. The provider says, can I do this for these reasons and get paid by you? And the insurer says yes or no based on well-defined, straightforward medical reasoning that it has already published. Prior authorization is used by health plans to oversee high-cost interventions. It is not used for medically accepted, routine, low-cost activities. And it is definitely not used for achieving political or ideological goals. In all my years working as a provider and for insurance companies, I've never seen prior authorization used as a weapon to carry out a political agenda. This is definitely a first, and I strongly object. As we've heard, this bill is an attack, really, on our ability to make personal health care decisions without government interference. And it's even worse than that because this bill was designed specifically to take those rights away from the poorest and most vulnerable among us. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Linda Schmidt.
He is not online, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Celie Davidson.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Celie Davidson. I'm speaking on behalf of Blue Mountain Clinic. We oppose HB 544, which seeks to restrict Medicaid coverage for abortion. If enacted, this law would act as a functional ban on abortion access for low-income Montanans. Anti-abortion legislators are not being responsive to their constituents. We have data from three recent public opinion polls, all of which demonstrate that a strong majority of Montanans do not want government to interfere with abortion access in our state. This bill does just that. It strips away basic human rights from those who are struggling most. If enacted, this bill will cost Montana taxpayers millions of dollars. Research from All Above All demonstrates that 1 in 4 low-income pregnant people will be forced to carry an unwanted pregnancy to term if Medicaid does not cover abortion care. For those individuals who are forced against their will to give birth, our public support systems, such as Montana Medicaid and by extension Montana taxpayers, will be responsible for covering not only the higher costs of labor and delivery care, but also the related costs of supporting young families who need financial assistance with housing, meals, and child care. Targeting low-income Montanans with this type of abortion ban is extremely malicious. A study published in January 2020 by the National Bureau of Economic Research found that when someone is unable to obtain abortion care they are seeking, it quadruples the odds of the new parent and their child living in poverty. In a previous hearing on the fiscal impact to restricting Montana Medicaid coverage of abortion care, we reported that the approximate increased cost of Montana Medicaid for labor and delivery care alone would be $2 million annually. This is an underestimate as it doesn't take into account the cost of prenatal or postpartum care, neither does it account for the cost of infant care or for the increased utilization of social support programs like WIC. Abortion care is safe and legal in Montana. Denying access to care for low-income Montanans puts their lives in real jeopardy. The risk of death from pregnancy and childbirth is 14 times higher than any risk related to
abortion. Can you wrap it up, please?
Forcing someone to give birth against their will is unconscionable, and Montanans will not stand for this government intrusion into our private lives and our personal decisions. We urge you to vote no on HB 544. Thank you.
Thank you. Jan Strout.
He is not online, Mr. Chair.
Debbie Cole.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Good afternoon, chair members of the committee. My name is Debbie Cole, spelled C-O-L-E for the record. And I'm here on behalf of Montana Women Vote. We oppose House Bill 544. Not only is it unnecessary and harmful, but it would further restrict low-income Montanans who need access to abortion care, significantly limiting abortion that qualifies for medically necessary, and adding in a pre-authorized review could leave many Medicaid recipients without the care they need. Additionally, if a patient and a doctor agree that they need an abortion for a serious mental health concern, House Bill 544 would deny them that coverage. And is the person that is authorizing this coverage another medical professional or just another person at a job getting a paycheck? We urge you to vote no on House Bill 544. Thank you.
Thank you. Hillary Ann Crosby.
She is not online, Mr. Sherman.
Thank you. Seeing no more opponents, we will go to informational witnesses in the room. Informational witnesses. Seeing none, we'll go online to Paula Stannard.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paula Stannard. That's spelled S-T-A-N-N-A-R-D. I am the Chief Legal Counsel for the Montana Department of Public Health and Human Services. I'm here to answer your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Stannard. Seeing no further information, witnesses, questions from the committee. Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions for a few different folks. Maybe I can start with Ms. Turner.
Ms. Turner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator, sorry.
I apologize to you as well. Friday, a very long week. Mr. Chair, Ms. Turner. I'm looking at page 2 of the bill and at the extensive list of documentation that must be submitted. Some of it seems really overreaching and private, and I'm going to ask a question of someone else about prior authorization in general, but you're representing the ACLU today, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, I am.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Ms. Turner, can you speak to, I have some privacy concerns about this, and can you speak to that, please?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gross, I would agree the American Civil Liberties Union of Montana has those concerns as well. Again, if we think about like equal protection for people under the law and equal protection for people accessing Medicaid services, you know, Medicaid is available at this time for birth and child pregnancy-related costs. And so if you're going to divide people into two, sorry, I don't want to put people in buckets, but buckets, one who would like abortion coverage and one who would like to carry their pregnancy to term, I guess I question why all of this private information about whether the pregnancy is the act of rape or incest, the medical necessity, and then under 3AB, I think any of this private information. I apologize, Mr. Chair, I was off on the wrong page. So on page 2, you're looking at medical history, age, current medications, medical conditions and allergies, number of pregnancies, chronic illness and surgeries, smoking and substance abuse, and obstetric history. I think that there is a concern that this information is requested and required for women who choose an abortion and may not be considered, for example, for men who are covered under Medicaid for similar issues, or for people who choose to provide their term pregnancy. And so I do think that there are some constitutional concerns under Article 2, Section 10, and that is some of the, these are some of the issues that the district court addressed in Jeanette R., the case that came out in 1995, even prior to the Armstrong decision.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. Mr. Chair, could I have a question for Dr. Roberts, who was online?
Dr. Roberts? Thomas Roberts?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Roberts, I'm glad that you hopped on because I had some questions about prior authorization. It's not something that I am as familiar with. And I don't know if you have the bill in front of you or if you can access it, but we have on page 2 of the bill very extensive list of documentation that would be required before receiving prior authorization. And is this normal? And can you talk about that? I have concerns about several provisions, but is this normal? And what do you typically see in prior authorization?
In my experience, this is unprecedented in terms of how much and how particular the information is, and not really needed, the vast majority of it. In fact, it's not needed at all to determine about an abortion. It's put there to discourage people and discourage physicians from using this process.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chair, I have another question for an online Ms. Fuller.
Ms. Fuller?
Yes, Chair, Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Fuller. I think early on in testimony we heard about telehealth, and if I'm reading this bill correctly, you'll have to forgive me. It's been a really long week, and I can't find it now. But I think I heard that the prior authorization has to be done in person. And can you speak, or maybe it was the service? Forgive me. But can you? What I'm trying to get at is the impact of requiring something be in person. And the impact this might have on telehealth services.
Yes, Chair, Senator Gross, thank you for the question. So our reading of this bill is because of some of the requirements for pre-authorization, including a physical exam, that the patient would need to at least have one visit in person. I will say that the use of telehealth, as we all know, for many kinds of healthcare across the state of Montana has grown exponentially in recent years, including for medication abortion. If we were to have a requirement where an in-person physical exam was required, certainly the patient could potentially get medication abortion by telehealth, but they still would have had to travel to a physical health center in order to have that exam for the pre-authorization. And our patients who use telehealth on average live 90 miles and 90 minutes from the nearest physical health center. And we're talking about folks who are lower income folks. They tend to work jobs where they don't get time off, where they need to arrange for childcare, miss a day of work, figure out transportation in order to access care. So that is yet another obstacle to care for those low income patients.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, one last question for the sponsor, please.
Okay. Representative Gillette.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gillette, you noted the rule in your opening new department rule that is, I think, still out for comment. It hasn't gone all the way through the process. So I'm just curious what the reason is for bringing identical or nearly identical statute while there's pending rule out there.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I mean, I think it can be fairly common to put into rule what is in law and vice versa, right? Like, it can be almost identical. I don't know that that's that unusual.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gillette, but what's the reason? It may not be unusual, but what's the reason?
Mr. Chair, Senator, to make it a law.
Senator Glenn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For Ms. Turner first, please.
Ms. Turner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Glimm.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Turner, you mentioned that in your answering of Senator Gross's question that this collection of information is not expected or not really not needed on procedures for men with similar issues. I wondered what those issues would be for a man.
Yeah. Chair Lenz, Senator Glimm, I knew that I would have to explain that further. My opinion, what I was speaking to is when men are covered under Medicaid as well for reproductive health, and there are reproductive health things that happen with men. I am happy to go into detail, but I imagine that we can all imagine that. I wonder if there is this level of invasion of their privacy. I guess I'm making that point to say that that could be an issue that's considered in future response to the passage of this law.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Mr. Chairman, can I have a question for Ms. Standard online?
Ms. Standard.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Glenn.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Standard, can you address that we've heard quite a bit about the privacy issue and the question of the information that we're collecting on page 2. Can you speak to that, whether that is getting into privacy issues or whether we're overstepping getting that, asking for that information?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Glenn, as the department proposed its rule, we did require documentation, and it's similar to documentation that Medicaid would require for other types of procedures, where there's a question about whether the procedure is medically necessary or whether it's for non-therapeutic or elective reasons. And because Medicaid only pays for treatment or medical services that is medically necessary, the department needs to obtain information that would establish the medical necessity of the procedure. It is held, once the information is received, it's held very carefully. The Medicaid program recognizes that it receives a lot of very personal healthcare information, regardless of the type of service that is provided. That information is for prior authorization purposes, is reviewed by medical professionals, and then is carefully kept. In fact, when we went back to look at procedure abortion services that had been covered, we had to physically look at paper documents because we only kept it in paper, so we're very conscious of our obligation to protect the healthcare information that we receive in order to establish medical necessity for services.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Standard, is there any difference in the privacy that one would need to protect based on what the procedure is? So, say, for an abortion versus a heart transplant or stents being installed or anything like that? Is there any difference in that privacy? And then aren't those kind of procedures, that isn't a lot of information passed on to the department in those type of situations too? Multiple other different procedures that are had, you get all kinds of information about the patient, but it's not a privacy concern. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Blum, department through the Medicaid program does receive and safeguard a lot of very personal health information of Medicaid beneficiaries in order to justify payment. Whether it is heart surgery or mental health services or treatment for STIs and STDs or indeed abortion services that the department covers.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Just one last one. Ms. Stannard, in the previous situations where we've had medically necessary abortions under Medicaid, has there been any kind of detail or any kind of explanation really from the majority of the paperwork that you've gotten, or is it just a box that's checked medically necessary and you don't really know why?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Glenn, as a result of legislation or direction in HB 2, I believe, from the 2021 session, we did a study of abortion services that Medicaid paid for. Currently, there is a form that is filled out by the abortion provider. It's called the MA037, I believe, and it provides three options, whether it's the life of the mother is endangered, the abortion is needed because of rape or incest, or is medically necessary. What we found is that in almost all circumstances, only the box was checked, and then a very cursory, a handwritten statement in some. I think all of the claims that we reviewed that were based on abortion for medical necessity, only maybe 10%, I'm trying to remember it, it is in the statement of reasonable necessity in for the rule, had any additional documentation or support. It was just a little bit more information about the situation and not really why the abortion would be medically necessary. I would refer you to, as I said, MAR 37-1024, published December 23rd, 2022, at page 2357, and we identify that the analysis that was done concluded that information submitted on or with the MA037 form lacks sufficient information to support medical necessity. With respect to medical necessity, necessary abortions, the department's contractor reported the MA37 forms contain a brief narrative, but only 11.31%, which was provided by one provider, contained additional documentation. Such additional documentation typically correlated with vague medical conditions of complications of unintended pregnancy or an assessment of the situation rather than documentation to support an actual complication or disease other than the pregnancy itself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Stannard.
Further questions from the committee? I think you guys all asked the ones I was wondering. Seeing none, Representative Gillette, would you like to close on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. Thanks for a good hearing. Just to clear up a few things that I heard, I think maybe you heard from legal counsel that it's not a state employee that is doing the prior authorization. We have a contractor that does that, and it's very, just like with all private health information, is secured. Also wanted you to know that what is being suggested here and what has been suggested in rule is honestly no more limiting for low-income women and no more unconstitutional than it is in other health plans. So other health plans and Medicaid plans across the nation do have prior authorization and for abortion services, including our military, like through TRICARE. If you're a service member in TRICARE, you have to go through prior authorization. That's just a thing. So it's no more unconstitutional for our service members that are here in Montana or other individuals who are covered under other plans or individuals who are low income and are in other states that require prior authorization. I wanted to be really clear that this bill specifically excludes an individual who has a pregnancy as a result of rape or incest. That is not in this bill. That is a different process by which, as I understand it, I think legal counsel was kind of talking about that. They just have to say, you know, this is a consequence of rape or incest, but there's no prior authorization process for that. And I did speak before this bill, or while this bill was being drafted, I did speak with the Domestic Violence Network and was very sure that I got that language. I mean, they didn't review this language, but the concept of leaving them out of this process. Let's see. I think just to reiterate that this simply helps us comply with federal law, just like every other Medicaid program across the nation has to as well. There's some pretty, actually, some pretty interesting reports to Congress on abortion services that are provided through Medicaid programs and their compliance or lack of compliance. I think that might be it, Mr. Chair. Thank you for a good hearing, and I ask for a due pass on House Bill 544. Thank you.
This ends the hearing on House Bill 544.
Mr. Chair, on a point of personal privilege, I would like to thank the committee and the bill sponsor and the public who participated in this hearing for sticking to the bill and for a nice, smooth, respectful discussion today, so thank you.
That was nice, wasn't it? Yes. Representative Gillette, whenever you're ready, we can open on House Bill 376.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Jane Gillette, House District 64, that's from Gallatin County. Four Corners, Gallatin Gateway, Big Sky, and West Yellowstone. And I'm here to present to you House Bill 376, which establishes a hospital patient bill of rights. I'm not going to go through every detail of this. You can read it. But what I will do is just highlight some of my favorite sections in here. Starting on page one, about line 17, one of my favorite pieces is in here is that a patient is entitled to be informed about information related to their specific procedures and treatments that are being recommended or planned, the risks that are involved that may cause harm to the patient, the possible length of their recuperation, and any medically reasonable alternatives and their accompanying risks and benefits. So that's, I mean, me as a healthcare provider, that's what I consider and what the medical profession considers as well, is that that you give complete informed consent and helping people understand both the risks and benefits and alternatives, medically reasonably alternatives, is an important part of that process. Going on to page 2, line 12, this was actually added in committee by another legislator from Gallatin County who actually during COVID had a wife who was pregnant. And so this just simply states that the patient has the right to have an advocate or support person of the patient's choosing present in clinically appropriate settings. Just a little bit further down from that is line 15, and this is honestly probably the, not probably, this is the main impetus for me for this bill. A patient has the right to visitation regardless of the patient's diagnosis. If the diagnosis or condition of a person at the end is at the end of the person's life, I'm sorry, hold on. If the diagnosis or condition of a person at the end of life requires specific protocols, the hospital shall make accommodations to facilitate visitation in accordance with the protocols and may not eliminate the opportunity for visitation unless allowing visitation would violate federal requirements and result in loss of payment. And so I'm not sure what it was like for you, but there were times, even outside of when hospitals clearly needed to be restricted and it was chaos and there understandably was lockdown, but even far beyond those times, there were times in hospitals where, I don't know, I got a lot of calls and a lot of outreach from people where they weren't able to see, you know, their wife in their last days of life or their child. And so that's what this bill is about. On the last page, which is page 3, line 9, the patient has the right to expect continuity of care and coordination of care between the patient's regular health care provider and the hospital. This is an important part. I think we've all just sort of experienced this, and we sort of expect that this will just happen organically, but it's actually a lot tougher to pull off than you would think. But we have care plans that are going on with our regular care provider, and then when we're admitted into the hospital, I think it's our expectation that the hospital coordinates care with our regular health care provider, and this just simply sets up the expectation that the patient has the right to have that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Proponents in the room. Proponents in the room, come on up. You've been waiting patiently the whole afternoon.
Yeah, since about 1 o'clock, but that's okay. So,
welcome.
Thank you. My name is Debbie Moran, and that's M-O-R-A-N, and I am here to ask you to support HB 376. I'll be really brief, but this is our story with my family of what happened to us and why I'm a strong supporter of this bill. In June of 2021, my mom and sister went to the doctor's office. As they were not feeling well, the doctor there told them that it was allergies, gave them a steroid shot, and sent them home. He did not test them for COVID because they still had their sense of taste and smell. On July 4th, 2021, Mom was admitted to the hospital, according to her medical records, with acute respiratory failure, with hypoxia, which is low oxygen levels, and pneumonia due to COVID. She presented with flu-like symptoms, a sore throat, cough, and low energy. On exam, she was in mild respiratory distress. Her records also show tests that were run, and her internal organs were normal. In her medical records, it states Mom was given remdesivir upon admittance. She was also asked and did take part in a clinical study with the drug Ampion that the doctors told her had been successful for patients with COVID. But with this study, she would either be giving Ampion or the placebo. We later found out that she was given the placebo, and when we knew she was getting sicker the longer she was in the hospital, we asked if she could now have it. We were told the study group denied the doctor's request for mercy and did not allow her to have the drug. We were not allowed in to see her and be her advocate for the first couple of weeks she was in there. The only way we could communicate were through text messages and videos we sent. Through those text messages, she was telling me that she was starving. They had not given her any food since she had been admitted. I called the doctors and nurses' stations daily, asking them to feed her, and to no avail. How can a body heal with no nutrition? They finally allowed my dad in about the third week she was in there. After they suited him up, she became weaker and weaker, and they asked us if we would consider putting her on a ventilator so she could get some rest and they could give her some nutrition with a tube inserted in her throat. The doctor explained that her body was working so hard it was like she had been running a marathon for the past few weeks with no nutrition. She was exhausted and her organs were beginning to fail. After she was put on the ventilator and continued use of her remdesivir, her organs were failing. And all of a sudden, it was okay if we came up to see her. She was also given, without our knowledge, midazolam and fentanyl, which happened to be drugs used for lethal injections for people on death row. She passed away on July 30th, 2021. Since her passing, we have seen hearings with Senator Ron Johnson and medical experts stating that this has become the normal hospital procedures. Hospitals are being paid very well for this protocol. Isolate the patients, do not give them nutrition, give them remdesivir and other legal drugs, put them on a ventilator and the patient dies. There are pending lawsuits that have been filed against hospitals for wrongful death for the use of these drugs, hastening the deaths of COVID patients. I would ask any opponent of this bill if you would be confident admitting yourself into a hospital knowing you would not be fed, be given these lethal drugs, not able to have an advocate with you or a choice on the protocol you are given, and see if you walk out of the hospital or are carried out in a body bag. This protocol is still happening in our hospitals, and it needs to stop. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents in the room? Seeing none, I'm going to go online to Susan Williams.
Mr. Chairman, none of the proponents are online anymore.
None of the proponents are online. Well, you're very popular, Representative Gillette. We still like you. With that, question to the committee then. Opponents. Opponents in the room, seeing none. Informational witnesses. Seeing none. Questions from the committee. Senator Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the sponsor.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, if this bill should pass, can you please explain to us how it will be implemented?
Yes. So, let me just make sure I have it here. It's been a while since I've looked at these. It's probably been like a month. Well, first of all, they're required to simply follow those rules, right? There are certain times where they'll be, well, through all of it, right? Whether it's informed consent, whether it is... like number 16, the patient has a right to be informed of available resources for resolving disputes, grievances, and conflicts, so on and so forth. Those are policies that are usually noticed around the facility. In a lot of places, they are posted, like you might see them in the elevators, the hallways, things like that. This is actually, I guess I didn't say this in the opening, but this is actually based off of the American Hospital Association's Patient Bill of Rights. Some of it's verbatim from there. All hospitals, as a condition of their Medicaid funding, of their CMS funding, are required to have a Patient Bill of Rights. And so this mimics, in some instances, identical to that. So it would be the same process by which they currently use in their hospitals for communicating the rights of patients. Do you, or maybe you haven't been into a hospital, you know, recently, but when you do and you're signing all the paperwork, those are kind of some of the things that you sign, that you've been notified that these are your rights type things. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gillette, we know that we all get a deluge of documents to sign when we check ourselves in. And thankfully, I haven't been to a hospital facility for quite some time. However, the doctor's time is very shortened, and the staff are seemingly overburdened. So how is it that we could possibly look into having it part of, you know, continuing education for the healthcare workers and or make it a part of, you know, hospital organizational meetings, however often that they do that? There has to be a more proactive way for the medical providers and their staff to be able to proactively offer this to their patients. Can you address that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think you make a really interesting point, and I would welcome an amendment in the bill for that. I will tell you that some of it, like there's one section in here that says that
patients have the right to expect privacy, things like that. And providers do do annual HIPAA training and so on. That's just kind of just like they do annual infection control training and things like that. So some of this I can imagine would be part of their annual certification process. But I think you make a good point of just holistically how, you know, how do we help remind providers and individuals working in hospitals that, I mean, they're for us, right? They're there to care and be sensitive to our needs. And I think as somebody who's worked in hospitals and healthcare settings, you know, for many years, it does. It gets hurried. It gets frantic. Things get chaotic. Things get dropped. And I really like your idea.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Gillette, it could be something just as simple as saying this is going to be incorporated in the annual HIPAA certification process?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I mean, I don't know that you'd single out HIPAA because that's specific to privacy, but it could easily be put as an amendment in here that it's part of the annual training that a hospital will provide for their staff.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none?
Ms. Weber. Senator.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Weber. Jump on in here.
I'll just have to yell at you. Okay, I have a question for the sponsor, please.
Representative Gillette.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Weber. I'm not sure how you can see me or which way I should face.
You're fine. You're fine. As long as you can hear me.
I can.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gillette, you know, my experience with hospitals and the JCAHO, which is the accreditation for hospitals, require this. You know, when I go to the hospital, even for, say, my COVID shot or go in for my annual medical exam, that I am informed. That's part of it, a part of the whole process of having your hospital accredited. And like you said in one of your answering another question, that you took this verbatim. Who did you take it verbatim from? Which organization?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, it's from the American Hospital Association. And I won't say all of it's verbatim, but a good portion of it is, and I'd be happy to share that with you. And you are correct that a large part of this is required, like the right to expect privacy, things like that. And it's just a little bit of a chaotic time, I think, right now in session. But on the House side, the Hospital Association did join as a proponent, just so you know. They weren't adverse to this bill, in case that helps you.
I'll follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Okay. Representative Gillette, wouldn't this be duplicative? I mean, is there? Do we have any state hospitals that this may affect? I see a lot of the normal hospitals go through the JCHO for accreditation. Is this for specific hospitals that are state run or state funded? I guess.
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, this is for all hospitals. And again, the Hospital Association on the House side came in as a proponent, and the bill really hasn't changed except for a couple of small amendments. So I'm gathering they're still a proponent, or they'd be here today as an opponent. But this this is congruent with what hospitals do and what's accepted practice. Again, it does have some clarifying language that just really spells out clearly that you have the right to be with your loved one, especially when you're in the last days of your life.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So you said that this covers all hospitals. How about Indian Health Service hospitals and public health service hospitals?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, those, as I understand it, are federally regulated, so I don't believe that this applies to them.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else thought of any questions in the meantime? Seeing none. Representative Gillette, would you like to close on your bill?
Yeah, I will tell you that I was getting texts from some of the proponents. I just think it's been kind of a lengthy, you know, time and, again, kind of a chaotic day. But thank you for a really good hearing, and thank you for spending all day here today waiting to testify. I mean, this is actually one of my favorite bills of the whole session. You know, even from kind of sometimes some sad things, some good things can happen. And I think this bill is testimony to some good things that are happening, where we just kind of lift our heads up as healthcare providers and say, okay, we learned from that, and moving on, here's what we commit to do to helping people and to helping families stay whole and recover through their illness, and do it with empathy and compassion. So with that, Mr. Chair, I ask for a due pass on House Bill 376.
Thank you, Representative Gillette. This ends the hearing on House Bill 376. Members of the committee will be just be at ease for a moment, unless you want a full break for 5 minutes. Just skip. Well, I want to make you get all your bills out. Have a couple discussions here behind the scenes. So House Bill 582. Hey, you don't have your stuff with you for executive? Okay.
Yeah, do we? Me and Carl really want to not do executive.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, what's that? Just do this? Yeah, if we can't. As by the, in honor of our benevolent, chair, that he wanted us to do these.
Benevolent? Oh, excuse me. He would be keeping us here at 5:44.
Yep, she had to get her binder.
Do you want me to do the motions?
What's that?
Do you want me to move
that? I just told Carl to do the motions. So.
How's the coffee, man? Yeah. How's the coffee?
Oh, I need to pull.
Hit it.
Let's go. We will start our executive action. Come back into order.
Mr. Chairman, I move do concur on House Bill 582. This was by Representative Windy Boy. Extend the sunset date for community health aid program, Mr. Chairman.
Any discussion on this, members of the committee?
Question.
Question being called. I think we can just do a voice vote, can't we? All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, no.
Senator Kelker votes aye by proxy.
Senator Molnar and McGilvery vote aye by proxy.
Beard is a no and Hindbaugh is a no by proxy.
Thank you. House Bill 582 has passed Senate Public Health. Carrier. Anybody want to be a carrier on this one?
I will.
Senator Weber?
Right here. Yep.
All right, Senator Weber. Thank you, Maddie, for reminding me. We will go on to House Bill 610.
Mr. Chairman, I move do pass House Bill 610. This was do concur. This was by Representative Gist. It was for an act allowing emergency care providers to provide patient care in a health care facility, Mr. Chairman.
All right, discussion on this bill?
Question.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Weber.
Withdrawn.
Okay. Mr. Chair, you know, this is great for small hospitals, and that's your EMS people, I'm assuming, and PCAs, those type of careers. But I think this is up to the hospital, as they know their need better than we will. So that was my issue. We use them here at our Indian Health Service Hospital in the emergency room, our EMS people. I think we're kind of overstepping a little bit on these small hospitals. I think this should be their own policy.
Thank you, Senator. Any other discussion? I have $0.02 to put in here. I was surprised that wasn't already happening. Representative Gist saying that, yeah, they can work in the hospitals or clinics, but they are constricted by what the hospital allows them to do. I thought that was unusual in the sense that, an EMT let's just stick with the EMT, knows what his scope of practice is. He knows what he's trained in, and there's the opportunity to kind of slump over him to other areas where maybe he could put an IV in, but the hospital hasn't allowed him to put an IV in or something. I like this bill. It was surprised me it wasn't already in place. Senator Gross.
Mr. Chair, so Senator Glim is telling me we have a couple EMTs here in the room. Is that because I...
X maybe is right.
Okay.
Yes, that is correct.
Old.
And
old.
Senator Weber, I missed part of it, and I... definitely respect your opinion. I have as proponents the Hospital Association. I don't have any individual hospitals here, but I also have the Montana Primary Care Association. And help me understand, again, because it's late, I'm sorry, committee, but this would apply outside of more than just hospitals, wouldn't it? Like the federally qualified health centers?
I did not hear that during the testimony. It was basically for, you know, allowing these, and you know, the hospitals, I guess it would be up to the hospitals, but to me, you know, most of them do, especially in rural Montana where I'm from, you know, where you only have one hospital. And for Indian Health Service, there's only two Indian Health Services hospitals in the state, and they use all their staff, basically cross training everyone. So, you know, EMTs, I have a lot of friends that are EMTs, and they are very well trained, and they always have to have continuing ed. But I kind of thought, Chair Lenz, is that why isn't everybody doing this?
Okay.
You know, it shouldn't even be an issue, but I guess it is.
Mm-hmm. And then I also see, Mr. Chair and Senator Weber, that it says on line 17, page 1, may provide. So I don't think they're required. I think the hospitals could still decide not to do it if they wanted, but maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, I think I'm going to support the bill today and then look at it a little closer. Thank you.
I'm going to have Ms. Krasowski look up healthcare facility, because they will operate in a healthcare facility, and its healthcare facility has a meeting provided in 55-101.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so under 55-101, healthcare facility, and bear with me, this is a bit of a long definition, means all or portion of an institution, building, or agency, private or public, excluding federal facilities, whether organized for profit or not, that is used, operated, or designed to promote health services, medical treatment, or nursing, rehabilitative, or preventative care to any individual. The term includes chemical dependency facilities, critical access hospitals, eating disorder centers, end-stage renal dialysis facilities, home health agencies, home infusion therapy agencies, hospices, hospitals, infirmaries, long-term care facilities, intermediate care facilities for the developmentally disabled, medical assistance facilities, mental health centers, outpatient centers for primary care, outpatient centers for surgical services, rehabilitation facilities, residential care facilities, and residential treatment facilities. The term does not include offices of private physicians, dentists, or other physical or mental health care workers regulated under Title 37, including licensed addiction counselors.
I don't know if that's helpful. Thank you, Ms. Krasowski.
Very helpful.
Senator Glenn.
Mr. Chairman, I would just say that this is a good bill. It's a win-win. Yeah, not only the other component of it that we didn't talk about was that these emergency medical personnel are gaining valuable experience too. When I was training, we actually got to pull a shift in a level 2 trauma center, and I'll tell you, on a Saturday night in a 12-hour shift, you probably gain about 2 years worth of knowledge of rural EMT, because you got stuff every 10 minutes, you got something new, and it's extremely valuable. So I don't know why hospitals wouldn't be clamoring for this, and likewise the emergency care.
Yes.
People wanting to do it, because it's a heck of a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say it was fun and gross at the same time. Question has been called. This to a voice vote. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
Senator Kilker votes aye by proxy.
Okay.
Senator Heimbaugh, aye by proxy.
Senator Molnar and Senator McGilvery vote aye by proxy.
Thank you, members. House Bill 610 has passed
Mr. Chairman, I maybe should just, for a point of clarification, maybe fun was a little bit the wrong word there. Valuable.
And, Senator, I've noticed healthcare workers have their own sense of humor yes. over the years that people outside of that don't have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 6.
I'm the carrier for that one, too. I'm the carrier on HB 610. All right, go ahead, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill number 655, do concur. This was by Representative Zolnikov, an act requiring Medicaid coverage of certain home births attended by a midwife. Mr. Chairman.
Any discussion on this? Seeing none?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say I really like this bill. I thought the sponsor presented it in just the perfect way for our committee. And I liked the questions that were asked. And I would love to carry the bill if no one else has been asked and if it passes.
Mr. Chair, just one little comment. We just had the midwives in, and they were very competent, professional, and I like this bill.
Yes, I agree, too.
Question?
Question being called. I think we can do a voice vote on this, too. All in favor of House Bill 655, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
Senator Kelker votes aye by proxy.
Senator Heimbaugh is aye by proxy.
Senator Molnar and Senator McGilvery vote aye by proxy.
Thank you, members. House Bill 655 has passed Senate Public Health. And Senator Gross, you can carry this.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, I move do concur on House Bill 684. Mr. Chairman, this was introduced by Representative Hinkle. Caleb Hinkle, and a bill, an act entitled An Act Prohibiting the Use of Vaccination Status in Certain Administrative and Legal Proceedings Related to Children and Incapacitated Adults. Mr. Chairman.
Discussion on this bill. No discussion?
Question.
Question being called. Voice vote or roll call vote? Let's do a roll call vote.
Chair Lenz.
Aye.
Senator Beard.
Yes.
Senator Glimm.
Yes.
Senator Gross.
No.
Senator Heimbaugh.
Yes, by proxy.
Senator Kelker.
No, by proxy.
Senator Molnar.
Yes, by proxy.
Senator Weber.
No.
Chair McGilvery.
Yes, by proxy.
6 yes, 3 no.
6 yes, 3 no. House Bill 684 has passed Public Health. Any carriers on this bill? Any burning desires?
McGilvery.
Senator McGilvery would love to carry this. Has his name written all over it.
Perfect.
Perfect.
Mr. Chairman, I move do pass on Senate Bill 564. Introduced by Senator McGilvery, an act revising the Montana Health Corps Act, expanding eligibility for service provided by health corps physicians. Is this the right? This is not the right bill.
No.
No.
So, 5.
I withdraw that.
657.
Here we go. It was stuck in the wrong folder. Okay. Mr. Chairman, I move do concur on House Bill 657, introduced by Representative Perry. An act revising laws related to the Office of the Child and Family Ombudsman, allowing a parent, family member, or foster parent to submit a request for assistance to the Office of the Child and Family Ombudsman for a retaliatory action by a Child Protective Services employee of the Department of Public Health and Human Services, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. I'll just jump in here right at the beginning. Every time I interact with somebody from Nebraska and they say, oh, the unicameral is the best ever, this is perfect. I thought of that when we were hearing this bill. How did this make it out of the House? You know, because we have the option of having it rest a while and then somebody else looking at it. Nebraska doesn't have that option. And I've often wondered what kind of nonsense comes through. And this was opposed by the Department of Justice and many people that needed DPHHS, that needed to support it. We've done work in this area. Moving them to an investigative body is a big bridge too far. And that's my position. I'm a no on this.
Any Mr. Chairman, I move substitute motion to table.
Could I make one comment before the substitute motion? That if we were moving to a unilateral body, I think that Senator Glimm could really consider retiring and applying for the reading clerk.
Oh, that would be. That's
I don't think
true.
I've ever got an entire bill title during executive action. He did it very well.
Substitute motion, the table is before us. Let's do a voice vote. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
Senator Kelker votes aye by proxy.
Senator Heimbaugh is aye by proxy.
Senator Molnar and Senator McGilvery vote aye by proxy.
Thank you. So House Bill 5657 has been tabled in Senate Public Health. That's all we have before us tonight. We got those out of the way, and now we don't have to do that later. I appreciate that. And Senator McGilvery is listening. Drive safe. Thank you, members.
Well, that was fast action.
There we go. I knew it.